Dedicated to the survival of American democracy in an increasingly dangerous world, this is Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney, acted as Assistant Secretary of Defense for International Security Policy under President Ronald Reagan, founder and president of the Center for Security Policy in Washington, D.C., the go-to man for defense and foreign policy issues, joined by the greatest minds in the security policy business, the special forces in the war of ideas at Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney.
Welcome to Secure Freedom Radio. This is Frank Gaffney, your host and guide for what I think of as an intelligence briefing on the war for the free world. Who better to provide an intelligence update than a man who has devoted his life to the practice and oversight of intelligence? He is Fred Flights, the Senior Vice President of the Center for Security Policy for Policy and Programs, a career intelligence professional with some 20 years of service in the Central Intelligence Agency. As an analyst, he also served as chief of staff to Ambassador John Bolton when he was serving in the State Department, and he has been a member of the professional staff of the House Intelligence Committee, the author of Obama Bomb, a great and growing national security fraud, and a good friend of mine, always welcome here, is Fred Flights. Happy New Year to you again, Fred. Welcome back.
Good to be here, Frank.
So, Fred, all eyes, as we speak, are on what the president is going to do about the Iran deal. By the time this program airs, we may have heard, but I wanted to get one more input from you about the stakes of him deciding to either persist with this, well, I think, national security fraud that the deal can be fixed, and persist in waiving sanctions on the Iranian regime, especially under the circumstances in which we have, an increasing opposition to that regime manifesting itself, which would surely be undercut by such a decision by the president. What are your thoughts on all of this?
Well, Frank, the president has shown remarkable leadership and moral clarity in standing up for the Iranian protesters, something that the American left and European leaders have refused to do. And I think he has to continue to support them by effectively killing this nuclear deal. There's a decision on the 12th on whether to continue to waive sanctions. If he doesn't, the deal is basically killed. On the 15th, he has to recertify Iranian compliance with the deal. I really don't see any other option other than the fact that the deal is a fraud. It doesn't appreciably stop Iran's pursuit of nuclear weapons. Iran is allowed to enrich uranium. It will get a reactor that produces plutonium. Verification is very weak. We now know that the billions of sanctions relief that Iran received under this deal have been spent on terrorism, troops in Syria, missiles sent to Yemen that have been used to attack Saudi Arabia and our ships and ships of our allies. It's obscene with these Iranians who were, their lot has been hurt so badly because the leaders have squandered sanctions aid. And the Iranians can't get enough to eat. Some are selling their kidneys because the economy is so awful. And we're thinking of giving Iran sanctions relief, extending sanctions relief. That's what's being proposed in Congress right now. They want to continue sanctions relief, and they are saying that, well, we can fix the agreement. Frank, this agreement can't be fixed. It can't be fixed. It is fundamentally flawed. The only way to fix it would be to stop Iran from enriching uranium and deny it this reactor and very vigorous verification. And that's not on the table for these reforms. It's very, very minor fixes because they don't want to offend the Europeans. And when I say they, I mean H.R. McMaster, Secretary of State Tillerson, Corker, and Cardin in the Senate. And it is an outrage. And my hope the president will not go along with this outrageous plan.
Well, I couldn't agree with you more, Fred Flights, and I think this is a moment of real truth for this presidency because he had promised to dispense with this agreement. He called it the worst in history. He has made clear his desire to do that. The fact that his national security advisor, H.R. McMaster, and his Secretary of State, Rex Tillerson, continue to undermine him in this way is outrageous, it seems to me. And as to this Corker-Cardin cabal, these are the guys who, after all, brought us the Obama bomb deal in the first place, in the sense that they engineered a mutation of the Senate's treaty-making role that enabled it to become binding upon the United States. Remind us of what they did in that context, Fred, and tell us a little bit about what they're purporting to do now.
That's exactly right. Senator Corker-Cardin put forward a bill in 2015, the Corker-Cardin Act is another name for it, which escapes me, that would put, basically would allow the Iran nuclear agreement to be voted on by Congress with a procedure under which Congress would have to vote to disapprove it, which meant that veto-proof and filibuster-proof majorities had to vote against the agreement. This was convenient for President Obama because a majority of Congress opposed it, but not that many. So basically, these two senators gave President Obama a way to get this terrible deal through, despite the fact that the majority of Congress opposed it. Now, this is a treaty. It should have been voted on by Congress under the constitutional provision that requires treaties to be approved by a two-thirds margin. Instead, it had to be disapproved by a two-thirds margin to stop it. And the Democrats had enough members to filibuster to stop that from happening. Now, there's something in this bill which is really troubling, and that is they want to remove a provision, that's Senators Corker-Cardin, that will require the president to certify Iranian compliance every 90 days. That way, we won't be talking about the deal anymore. It'll fall off the newspapers. And let me add one other thing. There is an alternative. There's the Bolton plan. John Bolton, who has been with the president from day one, has always supported Iran, him on the Iran issue, has a plan. He drafted last August. And my view is, you know, McMaster and Tillerson have been against the president on Iran since the day he came into office. Ambassador Bolton has always been for him, has this fabulous plan to kill the deal. The president should side with a supporter who has a plan to get rid of this deal and make America safe again.
Yeah, and with the Iranian people who ultimately are our best protection against what these mullahs have in mind for us, which they couldn't be more clear about, could they, Fred Flights? They've said it endlessly since 1979, and that is death to America. It's just a travesty that we've done what we have under the Obama administration, and unfortunately, to some extent, even under this one, to perpetuate that danger. Fred, let me turn to one other thing before we have to let you go. I mentioned that you had served on the staff of the House Permanent Select Committee on Intelligence. Devin Nunes, the chairman of that committee, has been doing, it seems to me, heroic work of late, trying to get to the bottom of this dossier business. We'll be speaking momentarily with Rowan Scarborough, who's been covering this extensively. But what's your take on what's happening with the committee, and particularly this decision by Dianne and Senator Feinstein unilaterally to release transcripts of some witness testimony about it?
Well, starting with Feinstein, she did not break the law, but she did violate the rules of the committee. I don't think members can be prosecuted for that, because the speech and debate clause in the Constitution. But what she did is wrong. Members can unilaterally release protected records and classified information that belong to an intelligence committee. They simply can't do that. She should be kicked off the committee for doing that. It's a very bad precedent. It looks like Nunes has soldiered forward to get information that proves that this dossier was bought and paid for by the Democrats to ruin the Trump campaign and was used to spy on the Trump campaign, to justify FISA wants to go after the Trump campaign. And I think Nunes really has been a fabulous chairman in standing up to the unbelievable efforts by the Democrats to politicize this, to politicize the committee, and to distract the committee from its important work of protecting our nation from foreign threats and making sure our intelligence agencies are as good as they can be. The committee hasn't been able to do that because it has been obsessed with this partisan investigation.
And the worst of it, in a way, Fred, is that beyond what was done seemingly illegally, certainly in a gross abuse of power to spy on the Trump campaign, is what was done with this so-called dodgy dossier to try to destroy the Trump presidency just as it was coming to office. We're a year or so after the revelations of its contents in BuzzFeed. I just wonder what your thoughts are on that aspect of this abuse of intelligence as well.
It's unbelievable that this dossier paid for by the Democrats was spoon-fed to the FBI and to reporters, some of whom were paid by Fusion GPS. This was a hit piece by a organization funded by the Democrats, and we're just now finding out how it really corrupted the Justice Department, the intelligence community, to go after a presidential candidate of another party. And this continued after he was elected. It is such a gross abuse of our democratic system.
It is indeed. Fred, we have to leave it at that for the moment, but I'm sure we will be talking more about it with you. We certainly will be talking momentarily with Rowan Scarborough of the Washington Times about it. In the meantime, my friend, thank you so much for joining us. Have a good weekend, and we will talk with you next week. Next up, as promised, Rowan Scarborough, right after this.
Visit us at facebook.com/securefreedom with Frank Gaffney. You're listening to Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney from the nation's capital in Washington, D.C.
We are back, joined by Rowan Scarborough, one of the best national security reporters of our time. He works these days at the Washington Times. He's also the author of two terrific bestsellers, Rumsfeld's War, The Untold Story of America's Anti-Terrorist Commander, and a highly topical book, Sabotage, America's Enemies Within the CIA. Rowan Scarborough, it's great to have you back. Welcome, sir. Happy New Year.
Thank you, Frank. Good to talk to you.
You've been reporting extensively on a topic we discussed briefly with Fred Flights in the previous segment, and I'd like to get into it in detail with you, Rowan, and that is this so-called dodgy dossier about Donald Trump and his interactions with the Russians, including some rather salacious charges that this British intelligence operative conjured up for Fusion GPS. Give us the backstory on it as you see it at the moment, Rowan.
Well, the dossier, of course, has become one of the most important political documents in modern Washington politics. And the irony is that it's not true. That's what the irony is. They're debating 35 pages of narration and allegation that has not proved the test of evidence. And where we stand now, Frank, is that Congressman Devin Nunes on the House side has just gotten justice to turn over lots and lots of documents on how the FBI used this dossier that was financed by Hillary Clinton campaign and the Democrats. And then on the other side of the street, the Grassley and the Senate Intelligence Committee is also looking into a lot of the same issues with the FBI and trying to bore down on the relationship between Fusion, this private firm the Democrats hired in the FBI. And in that light, Senator Feinstein decided this week to release Simpson's closed staff interview that took place last August. Highly irregular. You know, when somebody goes in and demands a closed session with the staff, that's a sealed deal. I mean, that transcript will always remain sealed. And in a tit for tat, Feinstein decided to release the whole thing because the weekend before, Grassley sent a criminal referral to the Justice Department for them to investigate the author of the dossier, Christopher Steele, for possibly lying to the FBI. So we have this intramural battle between Grassley and Feinstein playing out in the Senate. And then Nunes now has all these documents for the House Intelligence Committee, and it's going to be very interesting as he now starts to call in FBI witnesses, such as Peter Strzok, you know, who led the investigation from the FBI, the counterintelligence investigation. He's going to come in to testify, and also Bruce Orr, the associate attorney general, who has a very firm links to Fusion GPS because his wife worked there.
Right. And worked there as a Russian specialist. It's hard to believe she wasn't actually involved in the dossier herself. Let me just ask you quickly, there's so much to talk about in this, Rowan, but just to get my head around this, Fred Flights, having worked as a staff member, as you know, on the House Intelligence Committee, said it's probably not illegal for Dianne Feinstein to have done what she did, but it certainly is a violation of the committee rules, and said she should be removed from the committee as a result. Is that something that, in your experience, has precedent or at least would seem warranted in this case?
I have never seen someone take this unilateral action, especially on the minority side, when it was decided that this would be closed. And when Simpson's team started demanding that his transcript be released, Grassley said, "Well, come back in public then, and let's do a public hearing where we can ask you questions that we didn't know about in August." In August, they didn't know that the Democratic Party and Hillary Clinton had the dossier. So this raises all sorts of questions of what was his communications with the Democratic Party during the campaign? What did they say to the DNC lawyer who funneled the money? Those are very pertinent questions now that they know that the Democrats funded it. The Simpson side doesn't want to do that. So Feinstein, who, by the way, refused to sign a subpoena to get some of these FBI documents related to the dossier. Nunes has subpoena power. Grassley does not. He had to get her agreement on that.
This is an extraordinarily tangled web. As you say, this Peter Strzok fellow went on to, we've learned, run operations against the Trump presidency and is now in some hot water as a result of that. So the continuity of this kind of malfeasance on the part of people in the FBI and the Justice Department under President Obama, going from saving or working with, at the very least, Hillary Clinton in her efforts to attack Donald Trump on the one hand, and then continuing to attack Donald Trump once he was elected president, is extraordinary stuff. And you've done a marvelous job, I have to say, Rowan Scarborough, at the Washington Times, documenting and chronicling what has happened and letting us know what we've learned about it. Let me ask you, Rowan, about one of the other parts of your beat. You have been a national security reporter par excellence for decades, and I think very few people do what you do nearly as well when the beat is the Pentagon. Particularly, you have given considerable attention to the effects of the social engineering of the military that was really a hallmark of what I think of as Barack Obama's wrecking operation against the military, the last of which was his effort to integrate transgender individuals into the armed forces. I'm going to speak later in the program with a fellow by the name of Walt Heyer, who was himself a transgender individual. He has been very forceful in denouncing this idea of Obama's and what is sure to flow from it. I'm interested, Rowan, in your thoughts about what has happened of late, namely Donald Trump saying he did not believe transgenders should be in the military, federal judges saying, oh, yes, they should, and the Justice Department, apparently without any direction from the White House or the Pentagon, not appealing to the Supreme Court to overrule these judges. Talk, if you would, about both what's at stake for the military, as you see it, and what we should be making of this latest turn in the judicial process.
Well, it seems to me that Secretary Mattis has won the internal debate. I don't think Mattis is someone who would have initiated a transgender policy, but since he had inherited it, and, you know, people have sort of come out of the closet, so to speak, and transgenders are serving. I don't think he wanted to go down as a sec def that then, you know, started expelling transgender people again. Now, we know President Trump tweeted emphatically several months ago that transgenders were not going to serve in the military and we're not going to recruit them. And so everybody thought that as the policy's deadline came up in 2018, that would be put to a halt. But the escape route for Mattis was that this district court judge ruled that they had to allow transgenders to join the military. And so the mystery is, why didn't the Justice Department ask for a stay? Why did they not go to a higher court and ask for a stay while they order it at the appeals level? And we have not gotten a satisfactory answer to that. We are told that they are drafting, writing an appeal. But generally, if you're doing that, you ask for a stay to halt it if you really want to halt it. And they did not. So it's their argument to now go before the D.C. Circuit as to overturn the opinion by the district court judge, when in fact you've already started to let them in.
This is a serious mistake, it seems to me, Rowan. And I know that you'll stay on it. I hope we'll be able to get answers at the very least, if not get a request for a stay before more damage is done to the military in this fashion. Rowan, again, thank you so much for joining us and for the great work you do at the Washington Times. Check out his two terrific books, Rumsfeld's War and Sabotage, America's Enemies Within the CIA. Godspeed, my friend. Come back to us again very soon, if you would. David Goldman, a.k.a. Spengler, joins us next. We'll talk about Iran and Saudi Arabia and more with him right after this.
Now more with Frank Gaffney.
Welcome back. It's with the greatest of pleasure, I say, we are welcoming David Goldman as well, a.k.a. Spengler. You can find his terrific and voluminous outpouring of analysis and commentary at outlets like Asia Times and PJ Media. He is also a senior fellow of the London Center for Policy Research. He has more credits in terms of awards and past titles and authorships than I can shake a stick at. He is, among other things, a PhD in economics from the London School of Economics. But he's always a welcome guest here, and we've just agreed off air that we'll be visiting with him a lot more in 2018. A very good New Year's resolution, and a happy New Year to you, David. Thank you so much for taking some time with us.
Honor and privilege, Frank. Thank you.
Well, I hardly know where to begin. You've been commenting on so many things of import that I could go in a number of different directions, but I thought I might start with something that I think I was as impressed by as evidently were you. The president's new national security strategy, you described it as a game changer. Tell us why and how it, if in fact implemented, might make a real game-changing difference.
Well, there are several Rubicons that Trump crossed with the national security strategy. I think the most important was to say that we were going to do a layered missile defense, which is going to completely protect the American homeland from ICBMs. Even though the Bush, George W. Bush administration withdrew from the anti-ballistic missile treaty, we have refrained from doing so because we don't want to get the Russians and Chinese mad at us. And the Trump administration says, in so many words, given the way the Chinese have completely fouled up this North Korea business, intentionally or not, we are going to have to take our security into our own hands and do missile defense seriously.
I did see some sort of caveat applied, however, that they were going to try to perpetuate the, I believe, terribly misbegotten policies of the previous administration so as to not have a defense that would be sufficient to interfere with the Russians and Chinese ability to attack us. Did I read that differently than you or misread it altogether?
It's they've left a certain amount of strategic ambiguity in the document. Friends of mine like Angela Codavilla, who's a great expert in missile defense, thinks it's quite inadequate. But I believe they've taken an important step in the right direction. I give them credit for it. I think the second game changer is that they have identified the U.S. industrial base and engineering and science productivity as our most important strategic vulnerability, particularly with respect to China, and said that the core of national security strategy means addressing that. In other words, America first means fixing what's wrong with us and giving us the ability to enforce peace through strength. They've identified exactly what the problem is on the Chinese side, which is the massive subsidies that China applies to its capital-intensive industries, which have been leading to the gutting and deindustrialization of the capital-intensive sector of American manufacturing.
With grave implications for our defense industrial capacities as well. And as an economist, I know you would have appreciated as much as I did the sort of emphasis that the president placed on economic warfare that's being waged against us and that we need to be able to wage against others as well.
There are lots of tit-for-tat things we could do with China. For example, we could complain about the value of their currency. We could complain about the price of this at import. And that kind of small ball approach to trade is missing, thankfully, from the national security strategy. This plays long ball. It's talking about the integrity of the defense industrial base, the kind of things that would guarantee, if we apply ourselves properly, that America will remain the strongest country in the world and everyone else will be terrified to challenge us.
Let me turn to two related subjects, being Iran and the developments on the ground there. As we speak, the president is expected momentarily to make an announcement as to what he intends to do with respect to the Iran deal and sanctions. Secondly, the views and influence that is increasingly associated with MBS, as he's known, Mohammed bin Salman, the Crown Prince of Saudi Arabia, both about the Iranians and more generally about his own country, Israel, and the relationship with the United States. Would you sort of give us a quick take on both of those topics?
The Iranian economy is in dreadful shape. It's very much like Russia in the 1980s, just before communism fell. A good analogy would be Obama's Illinois, which massively underpays for its pension funds, its infrastructure, and has rampant social pathologies and the threat of bankruptcy. The Iranians are spending $20 billion a year or thereabouts for their imperial adventures in Syria. They're gutting spending on urgent programs. I mean, they're running out of water. There are millions of Iranians forced out of their homes because rivers are literally drying up. That's one of the reasons for some of the protests. Their pension funds are bankrupt. Their banking system is bankrupt. And if we keep the pressure on Iran and crack that economy, the real views of the Iranian people, which does not want to be ruled by theocracy, will come to the surface, and Iran will fall like the Soviet Union did, and the people will have a chance to have a more reasonable kind of government. So I think keep the pressure on, keep tightening it, and they will crack. That would be my advice to the administration. In terms of the details on sanctions, you know, let's see what they do. I don't want to kibitz too closely. In terms of Saudi Arabia, there has been a debate, as you know, Frank, in the conservative movement as to whether Saudi Arabia or Iran has been a worse sponsor of terror in the world. The problem is Saudi Arabia has never had a government. They've been run by a family. So some crazy uncles and cousins will send money to Al-Qaeda while the government itself will say, we've got nothing to do with terrorism. What I hope, and I see some signs of this, is that the Crown Prince Mohammed bin Salman will centralize power and crack down on the loony radical Islamist elements of the royal family and stop the flow of financing to Sunni jihadists. That will actually have a government, albeit, you know, an autocratic government, as opposed to being run by the, you know, the equivalent of the Clampets with camels.
Yeah. Do you fear that at the core, though, David Goldman, also known as Spengler, that the Saudis can only do so much because their kingdom is rooted in Sharia supremacism, is it not? And as long as that is the case, must they not support jihadism, terror, or whatever else you want to call it, of the Sunni or, for that matter, any other stripe?
Well, they're going to have to make a decision. The royal family has to choose between its commitment to Wahhabi Islam and its extreme form, which is pro-jihadist and barbaric, and survival, because the world simply will not tolerate a Saudi Arabia that stirs up Sunni jihad. One of the reasons that Russia and China have backed Iran, for example, is because their Muslims are overwhelmingly Sunni, and the Chinese will tell you that every madrasa in Western China has been financed by the Saudi royal family. They're very angry about it.
Not a few of ours as well in this country, by the way.
Oh, absolutely. So Saudis have to make a choice. The United States cannot prop up the Kingdom of Saudi Arabia indefinitely if it continues making those kinds of enemies and stirs up trouble. So I think the president was very eloquent when he was there last year and read the riot act to the Saudis and other Sunni rulers that they've got to drive out the jihadists. They've got to drive out the radicals. If they don't, that royal family won't survive.
We will watch this closely with your good help, David Goldman, Spengler of Asia Times and PJ Media fame. I had hoped we'd be able to talk with you about another important subject you've described as humiliation being the only path for peace in the Middle East, but that will be for our next visit, which I hope will be in the very near future. In the meantime, sir, thank you so much for joining us today, for the work you do, and the chance to talk with you. We'll look forward to doing it again. Next up, Walt Heyer joins us. We'll talk about gender dysphoria from a man who knows all about it. Why would we inflict it on our military? That and more, straight ahead.
Go to SecureFreedomRadio.org today. It's your freedom. It's your country. Frank Gaffney's Secure Freedom Radio. Go to SecureFreedomRadio.org today. It's your freedom. It's your country. Frank Gaffney's Secure Freedom Radio.
Welcome back. I am delighted to say we are joined for the first time by a gentleman by the name of Walt Heyer. He is a contributor to the Daily Signal and the Federalist and the Public Discourse online resources. He is a quite notable and accomplished public speaker. He has been traveling across the country for many years and is the sponsor of a most important online resource of his own, sexchangeregret.com. Walt Heyer is a man who underwent sex change surgery to become a woman, and after 8 years living as one, he reverted back to being a man. In a moment when there's a lot of talk and a lot of, well, misleading information about transgenderism, as it's called these days, gender dysphoria, as I believe it's clinically diagnosed, I am thrilled to have a chance to visit with him a little bit about his experiences and insights he has for whether it's advisable to have transgender individuals in the United States military. Walt Heyer, thank you so much for joining us and for giving us a bit of your time. I'm so grateful.
Yes, my pleasure. Thanks for having me on to discuss this very important issue.
Well, it really is important. It has become difficult to discuss, it turns out, because it is now very politically charged as part of the sort of larger agenda of people who are seeking to advance transgender rights or social engineering more generally in the military. But you've written about this, I believe it was at the Federalist Society back in July, in connection with Donald Trump's announcement that he was not going to admit transgender individuals into the military. Please explain why you share his concerns.
Well, there's several reasons. The first is that what we know for sure over the last, if we just look at the last 50 years, performing gender surgeries or gender affirming surgeries, the only thing that we've been able to prove for sure is that it has the consequence of 40% of the population are known to attempt suicide, and 20% of the population are known to have regret, and a portion of that 20% will request retransition or further surgeries to go back to the gender that was destroyed by surgery. So I don't understand why the military would put themselves in such a way as it's going to cost them perhaps double in some cases or triple as they go back and forth with these surgeries. And the individuals who undergo gender-affirming surgeries are not going to be prepared for combat. They're going to be put on the sidelines, and many of them are going to be, according to a UK Guardian study of 2004, after surgery, the individuals remain severely distressed to the point of attempting suicide. So I'm not sure that the military generals have looked over the studies that I see that have been out there for over 50 years that point to the fact. In fact, the one UK Guardian study actually says sex changes are not effective according to research studies.
Mm. Well, they certainly don't change your gender because that is, as you know better than anybody, Walt Heyer, something that is, I'm told, literally in every single cell of your body. It's not just various genitalia. Let me ask you about comorbidity. This is a term that I was unfamiliar with until I saw some of your story. How does that enter into the condition that these folks have, and again, the bearing on their ability to be part of a ready military, which is obviously what we must ask it to be.
Right. That's a great question, because what we have is that the word transgender itself does not identify a medical condition. It does not tell us about the psychiatric conditions, which are the comorbidities. So what we have and what we know from the studies is that individuals who identify as a transgender person and request surgery are people who are suffering from dissociative disorders, schizophrenia, bipolar disorder, body dysmorphic disorder, and many other psychological disorders that sometimes don't even surface until after they've undergone reassignment surgery. So we're placing them in harm's way by allowing them in the military, first off, and secondly, by engaging them in a surgery that's going to make them more vulnerable to suicide. We got to keep in mind that the military already has a very high rate of suicide, and then to add a population to the military that is known to have an attempted suicide rate of 40%, I'm not sure that the military is really adequately prepared to deal with this population when they're so distressed after surgery.
Well, that would seem to be the case for sure. You know, when you talk about putting them in harm's way, it would seem you're also putting their comrades in arms in harm's way if they are actually unlikely to be able to perform their duties in time of need. Let me ask you, would you be willing, Walt Heyer, if the United States Defense Department, which is supposed to be studying this matter now to provide insights for President Trump as to how to proceed with respect to all of this, setting aside for the moment these court orders that are superseding the president's Article II powers to be the commander-in-chief. But this this study that is being done by apparently a champion of LGBT agendas in the military, Anthony Kurtz, would seem to be someplace that would benefit greatly from your insights. Would you be willing to testify if invited to do so?
I would absolutely be thrilled to have the opportunity to bring a different perspective, one that comes with 50 years of research study that I've gone through. And keep in mind, I'm probably one of the only people in the country that has 73 years of experience as a transgender person on some level. I started out at the age of 4, and I'm 77 today, and I've been dealing with this for 73 years. So I have a great deal of resources, not only from the research studies, but from only my personal life experience as well.
Hard life experience. That would be terrific. Let's see what we can do to encourage that. And we're talking again with Walt Heyer. He is the sponsor of sexchangeregret.com and a active public speaker and contributor to the public policy debate. Walt, let me ask you about another topic related, but of a different sort. I've been told that next week, the House of Representatives in New Hampshire will hold a hearing on legislation that is designed to prevent, in that state, the mutilation of children for what's known as female genital mutilation purposes. I'm told that some of the folks who are opposing that legislation are now saying that they believe that there should be an exception made for the mutilation of children to change their gender. What are your thoughts on the advisability of such an amendment, sir?
The advice is that we shouldn't be doing anything to children until they're between the ages of 18 and 24, because their minds are not fully developed. And what we've found is that many kids who think that they're transgenders at a young age will change their mind. Somewhere up to 94%, I believe it is, will change their mind and not have a desire to be transgender if we don't do surgery on them and give them hormone blockers. We're actually building a nation of transgender kids by giving them hormone blockers and changing their genders when we shouldn't be doing so.
Yeah, there's a very powerful article by the president of the American College of Pediatricians along these same lines, and we're going to see if we can get her on as well in the near future. I hope you might be considered as a witness for this this hearing in New Hampshire next week. Walt Heyer, I'll see what I can do on that front too. But in the meantime, sir, thank you very much for joining us. I hope we can come back to you in the future, as we're doubtless going to be talking about this issue for quite some time. And your insights and as you say, your hard experience is incredibly important in forming it. I hope the rest of you will join us again next Monday, same time, same station. Until then, this is Frank Gaffney. Thanks for listening.
From the nation's capital, you've been listening to Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney.